Today on Code Switch, we're sharing a story from a new podcast called Inheriting. It's hosted by Emily Kwong, and it's a show about Asian American and Pacific Islander families, exploring how one event in history can ripple through generations.
This hour, the 1992 Los Angeles uprising. Carol Kwong Park's family lived through it.
And I remember thinking, not guilty, so that means they're not going to jail?
Carol was 12. During the chaos, her mom was stuck at the family's gas station. And Carol never understood how this event impacted her mom until she asked decades later.
So it was the first time she said that she was that scared.
Then on Life Kit, what to know before you post about your kids on social media.
Parents should be aware that they're not going to know at the moment that they share a piece of information or even a photo or a video where it might go.
That's coming up on Code Switch and Life Kit from NPR.
After this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Biden is ramping up his reelection campaign amid growing calls for him to withdraw from the race. For days, Biden has been seeking to shift the narrative away from his weak debate performance against his Republican rival, former President Donald Trump. NPR's Elena Moore reports Biden defended his record during an interview with ABC News last night.
Speaking with George Stephanopoulos of ABC News, President Biden acknowledged he was worn down ahead of the debate and it contributed to his performance.
It was a bad episode. No indicator of any serious condition. I was exhausted. I didn't listen to my instincts in terms of preparing, and I had a bad night.
Biden went on to dismiss a question on whether he would undergo an independent medical evaluation that included a neurological and cognitive test. The president also rejected current national polls, broadly showing him trailing former President Donald Trump. The interview occurred shortly after Biden spoke with supporters in Madison, Wisconsin, where he told the crowd he had no plans to step aside. Elena Moore, NPR News, Madison, Wisconsin.
Newly elected British Prime Minister Keir Starmer held his first official news conference since taking office. Speaking in front of 10 Downing Street today, Starmer said he plans to travel to Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, and back to England before heading to the United States next week.
On Tuesday, I shall set off to Washington for the NATO summit. I've already had a number of international calls, as you will know, and as you would have expected, to establish the relations across with other countries.
Starmer has pledged to reverse hopelessness that grew over 14 years of conservative rule in Britain. The economy, Britain's healthcare system, and immigration were among the top issues among voters in Thursday's national election. Activists in Arkansas say they've collected enough signatures to put an amendment legalizing abortion on the ballot this year. Josie Lenora from Little Rock Public Radio has more.
Representatives of Arkansans for Limited Government lined the hallways of the Arkansas State Capitol Friday as boxes of signatures were delivered to the Secretary of State's office. The Arkansas Abortion Amendment legalizes abortion in Arkansas up to the 18th week of pregnancy. A representative for the group signed an affidavit saying they have collected 101,525 signatures for the amendment. This is more than the over 90,000 needed to put abortion on the ballot in November. The Arkansas Family Council plans to challenge the abortion amendment in court. For NPR News, I'm Josie Lenora in Little Rock.
This is NPR News in Washington. Forecasters say a record-breaking heat wave will continue along the West Coast this weekend and spread into the Pacific Northwest. Officials say more than a dozen wildfires are burning in California, including one near Yosemite National Park. 100 life-size sculptures of Indian elephants are beginning a cross-country journey in the U.S. this weekend. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the Great Elephant Migration Traveling Art Exhibit is aiming to spread awareness about conservation efforts.
Artisans in Tamil Nadu in southern India made the enormous lifelike elephant sculptures out of Lantana camara. That's the tough, invasive weed that's been encroaching heavily upon the elephants' natural forest habitat, pushing them onto tea and coffee plantations where they coexist with humans. Tash Tekekara is a wildlife conservationist connected with the project.
So it's almost time to change the dominant conservation paradigm, to think of the world as a whole rather than this very binary separation of people and nature.
The sculptures can be seen in Newport, Rhode Island through early September. From there, they will head to New York City, Miami, the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana, and finally Los Angeles next summer. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
The Dalai Lama turns 89 years old today. The Tibetan spiritual leader and Nobel laureate underwent knee surgery in New York last month and is currently recovering in the U.S. In a video message today, he told the world that he was perfectly fit and healthy, adding that his health issues are only age-related. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. This is NPR.
Just a heads up, y'all. This episode contains some salty language, which means it's going to be some cussing.
Hey, everyone. You're listening to Code Switch, the show about race and identity from NPR. I'm B.A. Parker.
And I'm Gene Demby.
Okay, I'm going to get a little existential on you. You ready?
Oh, boy. Okay. All right, let's do it.
All right, so do you ever think about how the present you're living through right now is going to go down in the history books?
Absolutely.
Like, you know, where you were on 9/11 or what happened on the last day before lockdown in 2020, things like that. Like, we lived through that.
We lived through so many unprecedented times, but I guess all times are unprecedented, right? And now we're all in therapy trying to process it in real time. Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Well, our play cousin Emily Kwong from Shortwave is hosting a new show called Inheriting. And it's all about Asian American and Pacific Islander families and how one event in history can ripple through generations.
That's in our wheelhouse?
Exactly. Yeah. And the first two episodes are about how one Korean American woman, Carol Kwong Park, experienced the LA uprising in 1992. We're sharing a shorter version of those episodes with you all. I'll let Emily take it away.
From LAS Studios and the NPR Network, this is Inheriting, a new show about Asian American and Pacific Islander families where the past is personal. I'm your host, Emily Kwong. The year was 1990, and 10-year-old Carol Kwong Park was fast asleep when her mom's voice woke her up at way too early a clock.
Mom was like, I'm going to go to number one, Chuseok-gal-gya. I'm going to go to the station. Come with. I'm like, okay.
In the doorway, she could see her mom's silhouette, the halo of her 90s perm. The family ran a gas station in Compton, California. Carol spent her 6th birthday at the grand opening with hot dogs and a mariachi band. And now her mom was summoning her at the crack of dawn to come with.
You know, I get in the car with her and I'm like, yay! Because what I remembered at that point was I go to the station with mom and dad. Now it's just mom. I get candy. I get soda.
Like we're going to Blockbuster.
Exactly, right? It's like a little field trip. So I thought, you know, she just had to go do something.
When she got to the station, Carol could see the 12 gas pumps rising in the darkness, casting sharp shadows under the fluorescent lights.
I do remember a lot of, like, the smell of gasoline and, like, exhaust and street and oil.
And in the middle was the heart of the business, a small concrete building with just two windows, the cashier's booth.
She grabbed this plastic crate box, and she looks at me and she says, you're double digits, you know, you're 10 years old. You can work now. And I was like, what? And so I get up on this box because I was still too little to reach the buttons of the register. And she proceeds to teach me how to basically sell gas. This was back when we didn't have credit card machines. So they would come up and say, hey, $5 on number 5. and I'd take the money, and then I would press the pump number 5, then I'd type in $5, and then I would hit enter, and so it would turn on the gas for like $5. I can still see the buttons. They were different colors. They were white, blue, red. And from that day forward, I just felt like this is my duty. I will do what she asks. And so from then on, I was a cashier.
Carol had to work because her father had passed away a few months earlier. Her mom was still wearing all black, in mourning. Someone needed to take his place at the station, which was the family's only source of income. So Carol became the designated kid cashier.
And don't get me wrong, I did complain and I did get mad at mom, and I would be like, this is unfair, it's child labor, this is wrong, but let me go get my backpack, I'll be in the car and see you in 2 minutes.
I recognize this reflex of doing whatever is asked for your family's survival and having a ton of questions about it later on in life. On this show, we're going to ask those questions and break apart the AAPI monolith. Each episode is going to focus on one Asian American and Pacific Islander family and how a historic moment rippled through the generations of that family. We're going to start with Carol Kwong Park and the 1992 Los Angeles uprising. She lived through it, but she didn't fully understand it until she went back and posed her questions to an important actor in history, her mom. Carol's parents owned 5 gas stations across Los Angeles County. But after Carol's dad died, it was too much for her mom to handle alone. So she kept the one in the city of Compton and sold the other 4. But here's what the Parks didn't know about Compton. Way back before World War II, Compton was overwhelmingly white. And when black families started moving from the South into the neighborhood, they were met with hostility by white families, a lot of whom then left Compton. And this was a pattern playing out in a lot of American cities in the 1950s and 60s. After a while, middle-class black and Latino families left too. So by the 1980s, working-class jobs in Compton were scarce. And it wasn't just homes that changed hands, it was businesses too. Jewish and Japanese merchants began to sell their stores at prices cheap enough for another group in the middle of LA's racial hierarchy to buy. Korean families, like Carol's, who didn't know much about the history of Compton, just that it was a place they could afford to open up a business. The Parks lived in the suburbs, in a different part of LA County. When she wasn't in school, Carol spent every waking moment at the station in Compton, which is still there, on Rosecrans and Atlantic. I wanted to see it, the gas station, this gravity well of Carol's childhood. When we get there, she quickly waves us over. Her voice is faster than I remember, and she's doing that thing where she laughs whenever tough things come up. She points to the first thing that sparks a memory, a giant hole cut in the middle of a chain link fence. And I'm wondering, is she just excited to be back here?
People just hop through that fence.
A hole? Yeah. Oh, a hole in the fence?
Yeah.
Or hypervigilant. Because to me, the gas station looks like any other on this stretch of road. A little run down. There's a lamppost bent in half, but not dangerous. But the way Carol is moving reminds me of people in military families. She never puts her back to the street.
So these are 2 pumps per station. So 6 here and 6 over there.
Got it.
9, 10, 11, 12.
We turn, go to the cashier's booth. And I realize the windows are totally encased in bulletproof glass. Carol points to a bullet hole from her cashier days, pokes it with her finger, then motions to the trim around the building, which is a hip-high rock wall.
But see these rocks? This is meant for cars. Like, if a car gets out of control, this is what it hits. But for me, it wasn't about the cars, it was about the bullets.
Then I realized this is what Carol would use as a shield. So if there was ever stuff, you would drop to the ground in the booth.
Yeah, because I was always working there, so.
Carol continues her tour in the mechanics bay, and she keeps expecting to see this guy, Ego. Back when she was working at the station, Ego used to come by every morning and post up in a plastic chair.
And he would sit right here every day and just look out for mom and just watch everything. In my mind, he was like blessing our business.
And when he wasn't there, she felt exposed to all the violence she was seeing outside the window. Illegal guns were flooding into LA in the 90s, so gang fights got more deadly.
the LAPD was conducting these mass arrests, racially profiling Black and Latino citizens. And when Carol started working in Compton, the city had high rates of homicide and gang violence, 91 homicides for every 100,000 people. Longtime residents like Teresa Wyatt felt the change.
I would walk outside as a young woman, and there's a dead body of somebody I grew up with in the park.
Teresa is a minister and counselor who has lived in Compton for 55 years. And as a kid, living on Alondra and Central, watching drive-bys and hearing gunshots was common. Drugs made the gang violence in Compton worse, too.
I felt like the crack and the pills and the deeper drugs took over the city. A lot of the gangbangers were doing drugs, so they were fighting on a different level because they were high. So, you know, they were unaware of really what they were doing because they wasn't in their right mind.
And the city was not investing in the neighborhood. All around the Park Family gas station, Carol saw crumbling sidewalks filled with trash, fences around each home. The school nearby had broken windows that never got fixed. She began to witness stabbings and drive-by shootings. And the way I see it, the station for her came to have an inside world and an outside world. The inside world was the cashier's booth. Boring, but bulletproof. The shifts spanned 24 to 72 hours. Carol would sit on a blue cushion watching the gold-rimmed clock tick. She and her mom would take turns sleeping on a cot and eating from their rice cooker. On the other hand, the outside world was in constant motion. People filling up their gas tanks to go to work, buying cigarettes, gathering to talk, and it wasn't always safe for Carol to leave the booth and go outside. One night, when she and her mom were at home, a man tried to rob the register and stabbed two of the gas station's employees. The workers survived, but Carol told me that leaving the booth became excruciating, like when she had to take the meter readings for the pumps.
I hated doing that because I would run out, shine the light, look over my shoulder, write the number down on the stupid little pad, and run back in.
Most of Carol's time in the booth was spent serving customers, but those interactions were unpredictable. Some people were polite, sliding their money through the metal tray, but some were not.
They would slam their money down like that and go, "Hey, give me 10 on 12. I'm like, "What's your problem?" Right? And I'm a kid, right? I'm 12. Like, please, can you stop cussing at me? Because I have no control over how fast that gas is flowing into your car.
Customers accused her of taking jobs, of ripping them off. Some seemed to hate the fact that she existed, calling her words she'd never heard before. Carol was baffled by this. As she puts it, "What did my Korean face have to do with the price of gas and cigarettes?"
At some point, I would correct them, like, you can call me a goop. I'm not a chink, right? I'm not Chinese. I'm Korean. Get it right. If you're going to be racist, please, right? Just at least do me that courtesy, sir.
Around this time, the Korean presence in LA County was growing. By 1990, families like the Parks ran thousands of businesses in majority Black and Latino neighborhoods, gas stations, liquor stores, beauty supply stores. And Koreans occupied this middle position between the Black and white communities for reasons that Carol didn't understand. She tells me that her childhood view was narrow, framed by this one bulletproof window and flashes of hostility on the other side. So she started to fight back. The F-bomb became her weapon in these heated exchanges with some of her customers.
I was racist at some point because they were calling me these names, so I'd call it right back. I know that was extremely wrong now, and in my later adult years, I understood what was happening, but I was angry for a long, long time.
Carol says she became a truly angry kid, set off by the tiniest word or gesture. She attended a mostly white private Christian school in Norwalk and hid from her classmates that she spent her entire weekend working at a gas station, tried to make school and work separate dimensions. But the work was changing her, and she started getting into fights with other kids.
Even the principal was like, "Hey, Mrs. Park, you might want to have your kids, you know, go to therapy." I wish she would have put us in therapy, but also, Mom didn't know either what that meant.
So Carol retreated further inside
She told me it wasn't just that she was angry or constantly afraid. It's that she was alone, fulfilling a family duty in a community where she wasn't wanted. She turned to fiction and would bring library books to the station to pass the time.
I used to read Anne of Green Gables. It was my favorite, most favorite series of books when I was a kid. Like, my God, this girl is living a life that I wish I could have had. Just worried about, oh no, should I read this poem, right? Or should I, you know, hit Gilbert Blythe over the head with a chalkboard? Those are the problems I wish I had instead of the problems I was having, which was my dad just died. I got to work this 24-hour shift with my mom. But it's okay. I can read this book.
When I heard Carol say, but it's okay, I can read this book, what I really heard was accept the status quo and survive. Get lost in other worlds without thinking too deeply about what made Compton tick. By 1991, Carol had been on the job for a few months and was getting used to it, the shifts, the register, but the world outside was balancing on a knife's edge and it could not sustain. You're listening to Inheriting from LAS Studios and the NPR Network. After the break, the events of April 29th, 1992, and how this cataclysmic moment would set Carol on a path towards a deeper understanding of her own family.
Why would we do this? Why would this happen? Why? And I didn't get to answer that question until I was an adult.
That's coming up.
Stay with us, y'all. You're listening to Code Switch from NPR.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Okay, Carol, do you like chicken?
Yeah, I like chicken.
Yeah, how about cornflakes? When was the last time you ate cornflakes?
It's been a while.
Well, you may not know it, but cornflakes are a great way to actually prepare chicken. So we've got a great recipe for spicy honey cornflake baked chicken.
Coming up at 1 on WPR News.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. WPR is your home for national, international, and Wisconsin news, from breaking stories to the latest from the state capitol. Informed political and economic coverage, stories about the environment, intriguing conversations, and more each day on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy, clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
Just a heads up, y'all. This episode contains some salty language, which means it's going to be some cussing.
This is Code Switch, the show about race and identity from NPR. I'm B.A. Parker.
And I'm Gene Demby.
And we've been listening to the Inheriting Podcast as host Emily Kwong shares the story of Carol Hoang Park, who experienced the 1992 LA uprising as a 12-year-old.
I'm Emily Kwong, the host of Inheriting, a show about Asian American and Pacific Islander families, where the past is personal. Before the break, we heard about Carol Kwong Park's childhood, working as a cashier at her family's gas station business in Compton, California, in a majority Black and Latino neighborhood where a lot of the businesses were owned by Korean Americans, just like her family. And Carol was confused about these racial tensions around her.
I was racist at some point because they were calling me these names, so I'd call it right back. I know that was extremely wrong now, and in my later adult years, I understood what was happening.
Years of disinvestment by the city, racial injustice, and police brutality all across LA County. On March 3rd, 1991, four members of the LAPD beat Rodney King. The footage was everywhere. It was the first video documenting excessive use of force that really captured the nation's attention.
I saw this tape being played on everything, like channel 2, 4, 5, 7, 9.
Then, less than 2 weeks later, Latasha Harlins was killed.
March 16th, 1991. Latasha Harlins, a black teenager, is shot and killed by a Korean store owner, Soonja Do.
The black community was in agony after this, another young life taken. The Harlins family joined community organizers in the streets, calling for justice for Latasha. National Geographic was covering it, talking to organizers.
Stop killing our children! We want justice!
She got away with murder.
I damn sure hope so, that there would be all in the black community.
I hope somebody would care.
Would stand up and see this insanity for exactly what it is.
And there was a video of Soonja Do killing Latasha Harlins from the store's security camera. Carol was horrified by what she saw.
Ajima just shot and murdered Latasha Harlins, right? This is bad.
Suddenly, Carol's fights with customers became a matter of public debate. NBC News was just one outlet reporting on what the media was calling the Black Korean conflict.
In this overwhelmingly Black and Hispanic area, Koreans own many of the small businesses. They're insular. They employ their own. They keep to themselves. Blacks say that's the problem.
The trial verdict for Soonja Do
This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. Today, my guests are here to tell us about some very special work they are doing this summer in their Kenosha Unified Schools. The principals of Washington Middle School and Harvey Elementary School will be welcoming students from around Kenosha to their schools this fall, and they are making special preparations that they want to share with families and the community. So I'm going to have you introduce yourselves. Ursula Hamilton Perry, tell us about you.
Hi. So my name is Ursula Hamilton Perry, and I've served here at Harvey Elementary School as the principal for the past 13 years. Harvey is nestled in the North Side community here in Kenosha, and I've been fortunate enough to, like I said, be here for 13 years. Prior to that, though, I worked as an educator in Racine, in Atlanta, and in my hometown of Savannah, Georgia. So this year begins my 32nd year in education. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Shane Gale.
Hi, my name is Shane Gale. I am the principal of Washington Middle School. I have teaching and leadership experience at all three levels. I started after I graduated out of Marquette and been here almost 30 years in Kenosha Unified. Again, I've been at all three levels, but right now, currently, I'm working on moving the Washington Middle School to our new site this summer. And I appreciate Karen and Kenosha to talk more about it.
Great. Thank you so much. So, Ms. Hamilton Perry, could you describe to listeners why and how you will be gaining some new students this fall?
So, as many of the community members here in Kenosha probably already know, our district has undertaken a right-sizing project that started last year, I would say about October or November. So, that project has been, we've engaged in that project due to mostly declining enrollment across our state, which is not new or novel to the state of Wisconsin. It's actually a trend across our country, but declining enrollment equals declining dollars. So to be more efficient with our resources and not spread them too widely, Unfortunately, our district has had to take some steps that were in the best interest of our community, but a pretty long process. I'm happy to say there have been several things put in place to help with stakeholder engagement and stakeholder involvement. So again, the process began about October or November. So that has contributed to us accepting and welcoming new students in our building.